Real quick. Okay, several hands up. Just keep them up and we'll get them spread out. You can turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 12. Sorry, Genesis chapter 12. Now, the question that is raised in the actual program is, will there be peace between Israel and the Palestinian state? I'll get to that more to the end of our study because the Palestinians have part of the larger Arab people. I'm going to focus more specifically on the top of your outline, Arab states and prophecy. I'm going to cover that in three areas. We'll deal with the root of the problem, as it was involving two key individuals, Ishmael and Esau. Secondly, we'll briefly cover what the perpetual hatred of the Arabs towards the Jews, the light of Numbers 1 and 2. We'll deal with the future of the Arab states. And God does not have the same future for each of the Arab states, and so we'll have to deal with them individually, as they're listed in the outline. Now, chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3, you have the beginnings of Jewish history, because in this passage, God initiates the Abrahamic covenant, promises to make of Abraham a new nation. Two chapters earlier, in chapter 10, he dealt with the 70 Gentile nations arising out of the three sons of Noah. But not through any of these will he bring about the redemptive program. And now he'll pick nation number 71. They'll come from Abraham through Isaac and Jacob, whom the redemptive program will be carried out. The same chapter gives us the origins of the Jewish people, and Jewish history also provides the beginnings of Arab history. Arab history begins in the same chapter, verses 10 through 20. Shortly after coming into the land of Canaan, a famine hits the country, and Abram's faith had not yet matured to the point that he knows he could trust God in any situation. And hearing that the famine had not affected Egypt at all, he feels he needs to sojourn down to Egypt to be sustained. And we can label verses 10 through 20 as simply Abram's folly. Either he already knew this or became aware of it on the way to Egypt, he learned about a small quirk in the Egyptian moral system. At one side of the quirk, the Egyptians were quite negative towards adultery, and no self-respecting Egyptian wanted to be guilty of adultery. But suppose the Egyptian saw a woman he liked that was already married. He would not want to commit adultery with her, and so he would arrange for the husband to be murdered. That leaves the wife a widow, and there's no moral problem marrying widows. And because of that quirk in the Egyptian moral system, he tells his wife to pass herself off as a sister, which was half true. She was his half-sister. The intent was to hide the fact she was also his wife. And Abram's fear was realized that when Sarah's beauty begins to spread around the Egyptian system all the way up to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh takes and puts Sarah into his harem. Normally, in these situations, the father of the woman would receive the bride price. But the father is dead, and in the ancient system, then the brother becomes legal guardian of a single sister, and therefore Abraham receives the bride price. And note what it says in verse 16. He dealt well with Abram for her sake. He had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. And note the one phrase, maid servants. They're given a number of Egyptian maid servants. With that one phrase, we have the actual beginnings of Arab history. Let's move over to chapter 16. Chapter 16. If chapter 12, verses 10 through 20 can be labeled as Abram's folly, chapter 16, verses 1 through 6 could be labeled as Sarah's folly. 10 years have passed between chapter 12 and chapter 16, and no promised son had yet come into being. And after 10 years of waiting, Sarah feels that God will need some help to fulfill his own promises, a common mistake we sometimes make. And she resorts to the laws of that particular day. Now, often Abraham and Sarah are being accused of practicing immorality here, but that's not the issue. The laws of ancient days, if a wife was proven to be barren, she was then obligated to provide her husband with a handmaid through whom he could have a son so that the seed line continues. and showed they were resorting to laws of that day. But the point is there was no need for them to do so because they already had a promise that they would have a son. Up until this point, God never explicitly said Sarah would be the mother, but that should have been a foregone conclusion because Sarah was his only wife. And God will make explicit that Sarah would be the mother of the seed son only as in chapter 17. And we read in verse 1, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar." And Sarah happens to have an Egyptian Hagar, but in the context of Genesis, where would she have received an Egyptian handmaid? In the context of Genesis 12, among the maidservants Pharaoh gave them. And so she resorts to giving Hagar to Abraham, and the two have relations, and she does conceive. And we know from both testaments that few women were more despised than barren women. And when Hagar conceives, she begins to have the same despicable attitude towards a barren woman, which was her mistress. And we read in verse 4, "And when he went to Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes." And this despisement begins to manifest in several ways. And finally, Sarah begins to respond in kind. And verse 6 says, "She dealt harshly with her, so harshly that in her pregnant state, Hagar flees the household of Abraham." But in verse 7, she has an encounter with the angel of Jehovah, the angel of the Lord. I won't get into this because it goes beyond our theme for this morning. But this is not a common, ordinary angel. Maybe you see this title, the angel of Jehovah, the angel of the Lord, that is always the appearance of the second person of the triune God in his Old Testament manifestations. And the angel of the Lord instructs Hagar to go back and put herself in submission to Sarah. And he points out she will bear a son, and she's to call his name Ishmael, meaning God hears. But now focus on verse 12. He then points out four characteristics of the son that she will give birth to, characteristics that will continue in his descendants. Number one, he shall be as a wild ass among men. Now, God is not calling Ishmael any names here. If we use those terms of people, we're name calling, but he's referring to a situation that was dominant in the ancient Sinai and Negev deserts. They had their herds of wild donkeys that were characterized by roaming from one part of the desert to another. And that would be the character of Ishmael's descendants. They'd be characterized by roaming the deserts. In more recent centuries, a great part of the Arab population has moved into cities. But for centuries, this was the case. And even today, the Bedouin tribes in different portions of the Middle East still following the ancient practice of roaming in the desert. Secondly, he says, his hand shall be against every man. As he roams in the desert, he'll come into contact with other people groups, and his tendency will be to attack these other groups. He'll be characterized by aggression. That leads to point three, every man's hand against him. That those he attacks will then reorganize themselves and retaliation attack them back. And the principle of aggression followed by retaliation was a principle that's going to be true throughout history. It's even true with the present state in the Middle East. And the Arabs have aggressed against Israel either militarily or through terrorist attacks, which has brought on a heavy retaliation from the Israeli side. But the principle of aggression followed by retaliation was well predicted before the days in which we now live. And then fourthly, he shall dwell over against all his brethren. The Hebrew word behind over against has a double meaning. On one hand, it means to live side by side. The descendants of brother Isaac will live side by side with the descendants of brother Ishmael. But secondly, also means to live side by side with an attitude of hostility. And there'll be hostility from the side of Ishmael, his descendants, towards Isaac and his descendants. And as we have seen, these characteristics have continued to this day. Now go over to chapter 21. In chapter 21, verses 1 through 7, we have the birth of the seed son, Isaac, through whom the covenant will be sustained. And nowadays we have, by tradition here in the West, to give birthday parties to our children every year. That was not the practice of ancient times. The special festivities or festivals during certain rites of passage. One of these rites of passage was when the child was officially weaned. In those days, a child was weaned anywhere from the age of 3 up until the age of 5. And in keeping that tradition, verse 8 says, and the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. So in keeping with the practice of ancient times, he throws a weaning party on the official day of the weaning of the son. And no doubt he served Hebrew national weaners on this occasion as well. But there was one, they may not be good, but they are original. But there was one little spoiler here. In verse 9 says, Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. In some Bible picture books, they show a small boy mocking an infant. That's not the case here. Ishmael was about roughly 18, 19 years old or so, old enough to know better. And yet he resorts to spoiling the party by mocking someone that's between 3 up to 5 years old. Furthermore, the Hebrew word for Isaac and the Hebrew word for mocking is the same root. It would literally mean he was Isaac King Isaac. He was Isaac King Isaac. He was taking Isaac's name and the meaning and reducing it to mockery. When you go to public school, a name like Fruchtenbaum, you get the same treatment rather frequently. And this is the case with what's happening here. As a result of this action, Hagar and her son expelled from the household of Abraham, now begin to live the life the angel of the Lord had prophesied they would, wandering the desert. And read in verse 21, chapter 21, verse 21, and he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. Egypt today is primarily Arab and primarily Semitic because of Europe invasion in the 7th century. But at these points of time, the Egyptian population was Hamitic. But the Jews, they came from Ham. The Jews came from Shem because it would not be kosher to come from Ham. And as a result, we know from Egyptian hieroglyphics, Egyptian inscriptions, that the Hamitic population was quite against all Semitic groups. And by giving him a Hamitic wife, we'll continue the animosity towards the Semitic side of the family. And the animosity will even be instilled further. Ishmael is one of the two major fathers of the Arab peoples. Now, capital B, so let's go to chapter 25. The story of Ishmael and Isaac is the story of two half-brothers, but in the case of Jacob and Esau, we're dealing with two full brothers, not only full brothers, but also twin brothers. And although these are twin brothers, Esau was born first, and therefore he had the birthright. In the book of Genesis, Esau is characterized by someone that had the birthright, but could care less about the spiritual benefits of the birthright. Jacob is characterized by some who didn't have the birthright, wanted very much to have the birthright to be this in the program of God's redemptive program through the Abrahamic covenant. Now, they came when the birthright exchanged hands. In chapter 25, verse 27, and the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Now, throughout church history, Jacob has had a lot of bad press. He does better with Jewish commentators than Christian commentators. And because of this incident, what happens here, Jacob, in many of the teachings on Jacob, it is very negative. They characterize him as living a life of constant deception, though in Scripture he commits only one act of deception. Even that was at the instigation of his own mother. That's something he wished to actually do. But because that one act he performed, he's characterized by living this kind of a life, which is not validated by Scripture. And furthermore, in the anti-Semitic campaigns, this characteristic has been ascribed to Jacob's descendants, the Jewish people. Also not historically true, and yet that's what the Jewish people were defined as being deceptive and cheating and so on. And because of this negative frame of reference, this has affected how Bibles often are translated. Now, often the way verse 27 is interpreted, the interpreter says, well, Esau was the hunter. He was the he-man. He's out there providing for the family. Jacob was a sissy, dwelling in tents. In the context of Genesis, being a mighty hunter is not a positive, it's a negative. In chapter 10, Nimrod was a mighty hunter, but that's a negative, not a positive. And why did Jacob live in tents? Because he chose to follow the profession of his father and his grandfather of a shepherd, and the shepherd lived in tents. And Esau went outside the family profession. Jacob stayed within the family profession. I'm reading from what I think is the best translation of the Hebrew and Greek Bible into English, called the American Standard Version. This is the old one, 1901. And this translation reads, "He was a quiet man." You might have a different translation, but it's not because the Hebrew word is unclear. The Hebrew word is tam, T-A-M. Everywhere else this word is translated, it's always translated correctly as perfect. At least in this translation, it tells me in the side margin that the Hebrew means perfect. The Hebrew does mean perfect. But translators could not visualize that God would give this kind of a title to Jacob, and therefore my translation reads, "He was a quiet man." But the same word was used of Noah when God says he was a perfect man in his generation. The same word is used by God to Satan concerning Job. Job was a perfect man. The word does not mean sinless perfection, but it does mean the heart attitude of the man was right before God and towards God, just as David was a man after God's own heart. And so this kind of negative frame of reference towards Jacob has been instilled in translations. But the correct translation, as my side margin reads, "He was a perfect man, he had the right attitude towards God." Now verse 28, "Now Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison. Rebekah loved Jacob. And when she was pregnant with the twins, God already decreed that the elder will serve the younger. But Isaac preferred Esau because he liked the way he fixed venison. He made the choice that went contrary to God's choice, whereas the mother, more sensitive to spiritual things, chose the one that God chose, Jacob. Now, verse 29, "And Jacob brought pottage, and Esau came in from the field, and he was faint. Esau said to Jacob, 'Feed me, I pray, with that same red pottage, for I am faint.' Therefore his name called Edom. And Jacob said, 'Sell me first your birthright.' And Esau said, 'Behold, I'm about to die. What profit shall the birthright do to me?' Jacob said, 'Swear to me first,' and he sworn to him, and he sold him his birthright unto Jacob." Now people also accuse Jacob of taking unfair advantage of Esau because they take Esau's claim a bit too seriously. Esau comes in from hunting, caught nothing. No doubt he's hungry. He's not about to drop dead, as he implies. Often we husbands go get up in the morning, have breakfast, go to work, stop for lunch, come home, and they say to their wives, "Honey, I'm starving." That's not really true. You may be very hungry, but you're not starving. You're not about to drop dead. And we know the household of Isaac was a very wealthy household. All you would have to do is take a few steps over to the next tent, where there'd be a servant or somebody that could give him any meal he wants. But Esau does not want just to eat any old thing. He wants to eat the soup that that Jacob is cooking, his lentil soup. For a bowl of soup, he's willing to sell his birthright. And we should not miss the biblical writer's evaluation of Esau's action in verse 34. "Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage and lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. So Esau despised his birthright." Esau despised his birthright. He cared less about being part of God's covenantal program. But now Jacob has that birthright. Let's skip over to chapter 27. In Genesis 27, you have the account of the patriarchal blessing. Here again, Jacob has been accused of the wrong thing. He's been accused of stealing the patriarchal blessing from Esau. He's stealing nothing from Esau because the patriarchal blessing rightfully belongs to one who's got the birthright. Jacob now has the birthright right. And while Esau could care less about the covenantal issues, he wants very much to get the patriarchal blessing because of its material benefits. And here's where we have Rebekah's little folly. Like Sarah did beforehand, she feels God needs a bit of help to fulfill his promises. But they should have done simply wait and see how God will intervene, but they take intervention on their own. And she convinces her son to pretend to be Esau. And pretending to be Esau, he deceived his father, and that's where the one sin lies. But Jacob steals nothing from Esau. Esau's trying to steal the patriarchal blessing from Jacob. And the end product is in verse 41. Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father at hand, then will I slay my brother Jacob." And Esau is the second major father of the Arab peoples. Later on, Abraham had six more sons that fathered some of the Bedouin Arab tribes still wandering in the deserts of Saudi Arabia and Yemen. But by and large, the majority of the Arab population comes primarily from Ishmael and secondarily from Esau. And that's the root of the conflict. Now, Roman numeral 2, the perpetual hatred of the Arabs towards the Jews. Let's begin with Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. By the time we come to Numbers 20, you could assume that maybe Esau did receive the patriarchal blessing after all. Jacob and his family moved down to Egypt. The descendants became enslaved in Egypt. And after four centuries of wandering in Egyptian solitariness, they finally had the Exodus, but even then they end up wandering in the desert for 40 years before they can finally begin the process of entering the land. So by the Numbers chapter 20, the 40 years of wanderings have now come to an end. It's time for Israel to now go into her inheritance. And the most direct route from where they were in the Negev desert would now take them into the territory of Esau, the land of Edom. So Moses makes a request on a twofold basis in verse 14. And Moses sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Edom, thus says your brother Israel. Notice the phrase, your brother. And while Israel has other blood ties with some other nations in the Middle East, the closest of all blood ties was between Israel and Edom, two nations from two twin brothers. Then he goes on to say, you know all the travail that has befallen us, something they already knew. It shows that the Edomites kept trace of Jacob's descendants' history. They knew about the sojourn to Egypt, knew about the enslavement, they knew about the exodus, knew about the 40 years of wanderings. And that should have given Edom further sympathy towards the descendants of brother Jacob, but it does not. And in verse 20 we read, and he said, you shall not pass through. Edom came out against with much people and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage to his border, wherefore Israel turned away from him. And now the Jewish people have to make a 200-mile detour. If Moses has to lead 2 million people around a 200-mile detour, 2 million Jewish people, 2 million complaining Jewish people, all the way to the border of the Jordan River. As you continue to biblical history, you read often in the book of Judges and beyond how Ishmaelites and Edomites and others within that seed come out and oppress Israel, attack Israel, and so on. But now go to Psalm 83. Psalm 83. The first part of Psalm 83 pretty well describes the situation as we see it to this day. Psalm 83. And Psalm 83, verses 1 through 5, describes a confederation of nations coming together for one goal. And that goal is found in verse 4. They have said, come, let us cut them off from being a nation. The name of Israel may be no more remembrance. And the goal is to totally destroy the nation of Israel so that in the course of time it will be forgotten. There was a country called Israel within the context of the Middle East. The nations involved in this confederacy are found in verses 6, 7, and 8, and I'll give you the modern-day equivalents. Verse 6, the tents of Edom. Edom is southern Jordan. And Edom is Esau, a secondary father of the Arab peoples, and the Ishmaelites, who was the primary father. Moab is now central Jordan. The Hagarines will represent Egypt. In verse 7, Gebal represents Lebanon. Ammon is northern Jordan. Amalek would be the Sinai Peninsula. Philistia is the Gaza Strip. Tyre is also up in Lebanon. And Assyria is primarily northern Iraq and certain segments of modern-day Syria. Never in ancient history have all of these geographical territories combined together for the purpose of verse 4. This has been only true at the present Jewish state, especially in two of Israel's wars, the War of Independence back in 1948 and the Six-Day War in 1967. And Psalm 83 describes the situation pretty much as exists at the present time. And now turn to Ezekiel chapter 35. Ezekiel chapter 35. Chapter 35, verses 1 through 4, describes a coming severe judgment upon the land of Edom or southern Jordan. But in verse 5, he spells out the reason behind it. Because you have had a perpetual enmity, has given over the children of Israel the power of the sword in the time of their calamity, the time of the iniquity of the end. Note the phrase, a perpetual enmity. From biblical to modern times has been this perpetual enmity of the Arab peoples against the Jewish people, continues to this day. And furthermore, this perpetual enmity has spread to those who might be supportive of Israel. And that's why there's such strong animosity of the Arab world and the larger Muslim world against the USA, because of its continuous support for Israel from 48 onward. Now, I was in Canada when the attack on the Twin Towers occurred in New York, in Quebec, and I listened to the CNN program in English, and the day or two after the attack, the CNN reporters were interviewing three different Arab leaders of three different terrorist groups. They all said the same thing. Number one, none of them were involved with the attack. But number two, the reason it came is because of American support towards Israel. And the animosity towards the USA is because of American support for Israel and for the Jewish state. And if that ever fails, then there might be more Arab support, but there'll be more judgment from God, as we'll see. But this has been the problem ever since, this perpetual animosity. In light of that, then, going now to Roman numeral 3, what will be the future of the Arab states? In capital A, peace will come by divine intervention in three different ways. With some, it'll come by means of occupation. Secondly, with some will come by means of destruction. And then thirdly, with some it will come by means of conversion. And we'll take these one by one. First of all, Lebanon. The passage you want to mark down for this is Ezekiel chapter 47, verse 13, through chapter 48, verse 29. Ezekiel chapter 47, verse 13 through chapter 48, verse 29. It describes Israel in the Messianic kingdom and provides the borders of the promised land. They'll be fully settled by Israel in the Messianic kingdom. And if you take those borders, the modern-day Middle East map will include all of Lebanon. Lebanon has always been part of the promised land. Lebanon has also been that part of the promised land the Jewish people never had, even in the days of David and Solomon. And but in the kingdom, there'll be no country called Lebanon. It'll simply be part of the Malil Israel, Messianic Israel, as some of the tribes of Israel, the north, will be settling in what is today Lebanon. So peace will come between Israel and Lebanon by means of occupation. Now, point two, Jordan. Modern-day Jordan comprises three ancient territories, Edom, Moab, and Ammon, and God does not quite have the same future for all three territories. Now, dealing with the way God will deal with the Arab states, he'll use two basic principles. The first principle is how close the blood tie is. Now, the closer the blood tie, the greater degree of judgment. The closer the blood tie, the greater responsibility and the greater accountability, and therefore the greater the judgment. The second principle he will use is the length and history of the anti-Semitism of that country. And those two principles will determine each of these individual Arab countries' future. So dealing with small Edom, which is now southern Jordan, peace will come between Israel and southern Jordan by means of a total destruction. Look at chapter 35 again of Ezekiel, look at verse 6. Therefore, what for? Because of that perpetual enmity. Therefore, says as thou livest, Lord Jehovah, I will prepare you unto blood, and blood shall pursue you. Since you did not hate blood, therefore blood shall pursue you. This will make Mount Seir an astonishment and a desolation. I will cut off from it him that passes through and him that returns. I will fill the mountains with the slain, in your hills, in your valleys, in all your watercourses shall they fall by the where thou shalt be slain with the sword. I will make you a perpetual desolation, and your cities shall not be inhabited. You shall know that I am Jehovah. Skip down to verse 15. As you did rejoice over the inheritance of the house of Israel because it was desolate, so I do unto you. You shall be desolate, O Mount Seir, and all Edom, even all of it. They shall know that I am Jehovah. Those are the pictures that of a total desolation, no human inhabitants going in or going out. There'll be a land of continuous desolation. And while the whole world elsewhere will be largely beautified in the kingdom, blossoming like the Garden of Eden, that will not be true with certain parts of what is now the Arab world. One of these parts will be the land of Southern Jordan, be a land of total desolation. We'll see some more on it shortly. If you take your notes, you can also mark down Jeremiah chapter 49, verses 7 through 20. Jeremiah 49, verses 7 through 20. For our purpose, let's turn to the book of Obadiah. He's the fourth minor prophet. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. The whole theme of Obadiah's book happens to be the coming destruction of Edom or Southern Jordan. And look at verse 17. I'm not sure what chapter it's in, but it's in verse 17 of that chapter. Obadiah, verse 17. But in Mount Zion there shall be those that escape. It shall be holy. And the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame, the house of Esau for stubble. They shall burn among them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining to the house of Esau. But Jehovah had spoken it. And notice he says that Esau will not have a single descendant left living once the kingdom is established. The annihilation process of God's judgment will be total, and Esau will not have any descendants that will be in the Messianic kingdom. Now turn to turn first to Isaiah chapter 34. Isaiah chapter 34. Now keep your finger in Isaiah 34. We'll come back to it momentarily. And turn to Ezekiel 25 because this passage builds another one. Keep your finger in Isaiah 34 and look at Ezekiel chapter 25. We saw in chapter 35 we'll have no inhabitants of the humankind, but it gets well beyond that. Chapter 25 of Ezekiel, verse 12. 25, verse 12. Thus says the Lord Jehovah, because that Edom has dealt against the house of Judah by taking vengeance, had greatly offended and revenged himself upon them. Therefore, thus says the Lord Jehovah, I will stretch out my hand upon Edom, will cut off man and beast from it. I will make it desolate from Teman, even to day done shall they fall by the sword. I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel. They shall do in Edom according to mine anger and according to my wrath. They shall know my vengeance, says the Lord Jehovah. Notice in this passage, not only will Edom be totally emptied of human inhabitants, also of all animal inhabitants. I will cut off both man and beast from it. And he points out initially God will use the people of Israel to render judgment upon Edom, and God will use Israel as far as he intends to, but he will do something else. Now look at chapter 34 of Isaiah. Chapter 34, verse 8. 34, verse 8. For Jehovah had a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. And the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, the dust thereof into brimstone, the land thereof shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go out forever from generation to generation and shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. But the pelican, the porcupine shall possess it. The owl and the raven shall dwell therein. He will stretch over it the line of confusion, the plummet of emptiness. They shall call the nobles thereof to the kingdom, but none shall be there. And all the princes shall be nothing. And thorns and thistles shall come up in the palaces, and nettles and thistles in the fortresses thereof, and there shall be a habitation of jackals, a court for ostriches. And the wild beasts of the desert shall meet with the wolves, and the wild goat shall cry to his fellow, and yea, the night monster shall settle them, and shall find her a place of rest, all the way down to verse 17. Notice that God also says that after he uses Israel in the Ezekiel passage, he will then rain fire and brimstone upon the whole land of Edom. And for the whole thousand-year kingdom, there will be a continuous rising smoke upon the land of Southern Jordan, a land of burning pitch and burning brimstone. Ezekiel says he will cut off both man and beast from it, but Ezekiel mentions animals will be dwelling there. That would appear initially to be a contradiction of Ezekiel's prophecy. But animals of this nature, if they were little animals, could not survive in a land of burning pitch and burning brimstone. They'd be burned up. But in verse 14, we're given two words that we have more clearly defined in Hebrew. And the Hebrew word behind the wild goat is the Hebrew word meaning demons in goat form. Demons in goat form. And the word that in this translation reads night monster is the Hebrew word meaning demons of the night. Demons operate in the night hours. Now we know from other passages that good angels have certain kinds of animal type features at times, like the seraphim and the cherubim. The same thing is true with the fallen ones. You now describe being little animals that cannot live in the land of burning pitch and burning brimstone. As Ezekiel said, all little animals would be cut off in the land of Edom. And while Satan will be confined in the abyss, if for the thousand-year kingdom, his demons will not be there with him. They'll be in two other localities right here on earth. One of these two localities is that they'll be confined to the land of Edom or Southern Jordan. They'd not be able to roam around to do any temptations. They'll be confined in this territory and live for 1,000 years in the land of burning pitch and burning brimstone. So peace would come between Israel and Egypt by means of Israel and Edom, rather, Southern Jordan, by means of a destruction that'll be absolutely total. Let's go down to small b, Moab, and turn to Jeremiah 48. Jeremiah 48. Moab is today Central Jordan, and peace will come between Israel and Central Jordan by means of conversion. In chapter 48, verses 1 through 46, 1 through 43 describes a partial judgment upon the land of Moab. As a result of this judgment, those who survive will come to faith. And then verse 47 says, yet will I bring back the captivity of Moab in the latter days, says Jehovah. Thus far is the judgment of Moab. And there will be a saved nation called Moab in the Messianic kingdom. As for small c, Ammon, Ammon today is northern Jordan. And the same as with Moab, will come by means of conversion. And in Jeremiah chapter 49, verses 1 through 5, chapter 49, 1 through 5, there'll be a partial judgment, a partial destruction of the land of Ammon, causing the survivors to come to faith. And verse 6 says, and afterward will I bring back the captivity of the children of Ammon, says Jehovah. So while there be no land of Edom anymore in the kingdom, there will be a nation of Ammon, a nation of Moab. Now, Moab and Ammon are also blood tied to Israel, but a bit more distant than Edom, because Ammon and Moab came from the two daughters of Lot, through Lot, and Lot was the nephew of Abraham. And because the blood tie is a bit more distant, the accountability is also a bit less strict than it was with Edom. Let's go to Egypt and turn to Isaiah 19. Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah chapter 19, verses 1 through 10. Isaiah 19, verses 1 through 10. Since the Egypt will fall into a state of confusion, disorganization, anarchy, and civil war. In a church I was nearby, and I was speaking not church, but I was in a nearby church, the pastor of this other church got up and says, we're seeing verses 1 and 2 being fulfilled right now in Egypt in real time. He's not sure about verse 3 onward, but verses 1 and 2 is now being fulfilled. It's a bit too premature to make that identification. Before we begin to say this is that, we have to sit back and wait to see just how prophecy is fulfilled. And keep in mind, prophecy is never fulfilled approximately. It's fulfilled precisely as it is written. So I think it's a bit premature, but time will tell what happens. In verses 11 through 15, he points out the reason all these terrible things have happened to Egypt is because they've been led astray by their own leaders. Even our present-day history, three different leaders have thrown Egypt into three major wars with Israel, with heavy devastation of the Egyptian economy and the Egyptian army. But then, using a prophetic phrase in that day, he points out eventually there'll be a national salvation of the land of Egypt in three different stages. Verse 16, in that day shall the Egyptian be like Tubin, and they shall tremble and fear because of the shaking of the hand of Jehovah's host, which he shall shake over them. The land of Judah shall become a terror unto Egypt, and so on. And the point he makes is that Egypt will develop a fear of Israel. This has not been true in ancient times, and even in the days of Solomon, the Egyptian army went right through the land with impunity. This has been true primarily since 1948, when the Egyptians had developed this unusual fear of the people of Israel. Verse 18, in that day, he points out, five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan. The language of Canaan in Isaiah's day was the Hebrew language. So there'll be five settlements or cities within the Egyptian territory that will be speaking Hebrew, not Arabic. Just how this will be fulfilled, time will tell. Then it comes to the real turning point in verses 19 to 22. He points out here the Egyptians will fall under cruel dictatorship. And because of this cruel dictatorship, they will finally turn away from Islam and turn to the God of Israel, to the Messiah Yeshua, the Messiah Jesus, and there'll be a national salvation of the Egyptians. And verse 21 says, Jehovah shall be known to Egypt. The Egyptians shall know Jehovah in that day. Yea, they shall worship with sacrifice and oblation, shall vow a vow to Jehovah, and shall perform it. And Jehovah will smite Egypt, smiting and healing. And they shall return to Jehovah. He will be entreated of them and will heal them. And so there will someday be a national salvation of the Egyptians. They'll suffer a partial destruction by the hand of God. But then they'll turn to faith and worship the God of Israel. However, Egypt has been the longest, the oldest anti-Semitic nation. Anti-Semitism begins with the book of Exodus, chapter 1. And a long history of anti-Semitism cannot be excused in light of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. So more light is given. You can mark this down for your notes. Ezekiel chapter 29, verses 1 through 16. Ezekiel chapter 29, 1 through 16. He points out for the first 40 years of the thousand-year kingdom, the Egyptians will all be dispersed around the world, scattered like the way we Jews have been scattered since AD 70. The land of Egypt will be desolate with no inhabitants whatsoever. But after 40 years of dispersion and desolation, the Egyptians will be brought back into the land of Egypt. They'll settle Egypt, and for the remaining 960 years of the kingdom, there'll be a saved nation called Egypt in the land of Egypt. And another passage you can mark down, Zechariah chapter 14, verses 16 through 21. Zechariah 14, 16 and 21. Every year the Egyptians, along with other nations, will be sending delegations to Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. And so they have initial negative future followed by a very positive future. Page 2. I don't have a page 2. Somebody have a copy of the outline. Okay, number 4, Iraq. Modern-day Iraq comprises 2 ancient territories. Northern Iraq is Syria, southern Iraq is Babylonia. Not quite the same future for Syria. Northern Iraq, peace will come between Israel and northern Iraq and Syria by means of conversion. Go back to Isaiah 19 and look at verse 23. In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrian shall come into Egypt, Egyptian to Assyria. The Egyptians shall worship with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt, and with Assyria, a blessing in the midst of all the earth. For that Jehovah hosts have blessed them, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. And notice he points out there will be a national salvation of Assyria or northern Iraq. The highway he mentions in verse 23 is the famous ancient highway called the Via Maris, the main trade route from Egypt into the Mesopotamian regions. It's been closed in 1948, but with the treaty with Egypt, the southern has been opened, but not the northern section. However, when the kingdom is established with Egypt and northern Iraq as saved nations, there'll be easy access to Israel, trading between Egypt and Israel. But not only will there be an economic union, there'll be a spiritual union in verses 24 and 25. And they'll all worship the same God, the same Messiah, the same Savior. And normally in Isaiah, when you see the phrase, my people, always refers to Jewish people, but here's the one exception. He says, blessed be Egypt, my people. Assyria, the work of my hands, is with my inheritance. And you have the three great powers of the kingdom in the Messianic kingdom. As for Babylonia, let me give you five passages to mark down. We don't have time to look at them. But the five passages are, first of all, Isaiah chapters 13 and 14. Isaiah 13 and 14, Jeremiah chapters 15 and 51, Jeremiah chapters 15 and 51, and then Revelation chapter 18. And peace will come between Israel and Babylonia, or southern Iraq, also by means of a total destruction. And as he does with Edom, so he will do with southern Iraq, burning, they'll rain down upon it, fire and brimstone. And it'll also be a land of burning pitch and burning brimstone. And demons not confined in southern Jordan will be confined in southern Iraq. And these will be the two places of confinement for demons in the Messianic kingdom. So peace will come between Israel and Babylonia, southern Iraq, by means of a total destruction. Number five, Saudi Arabia. The passage to mark down is Jeremiah chapter 49, verses 28 through 33. Jeremiah 49, 28 through 33. Peace will come between Israel and Saudi Arabia also by means of destruction. It'll be told in the sense there'll be no inhabitants in Saudi Arabia anymore. It won't go as far as having burning pitch and burning brimstone. It's not quite as severe as southern Jordan and southern Iraq. Okay, we have just enough time to do one more country. Number six, Iran, also in Jeremiah 49. Although I'm Jewish, right about now I begin to feel like an Egyptian mummy. Pressed for time. Some of you are a bit slow on that one. Iran is the old name Persia, and before Persia was called Elam, which is what the name is in verses 34 through 39. And peace will come between Israel and Iran by means of conversion. As a point of technicality, Iran is not an Arab country, it's a Persian country. The language is not Arabic, but Farsi. What they share with the Arab population is the religion of Islam, but that's not their ethnic identity. They are Persian by ethnic identity with a Persian language. And in verses 34 through 38, he points out there'll be a partial judgment upon the land of what is now Iran. And as a result of this judgment and partial destruction, the survivors will come to faith. And verse 39 says, But it shall come to pass in latter days, so I'll bring back the captivity of Elam, says Jehovah, and it will be a country known by its older name as a saved nation in the kingdom. So on the question, are we pessimistic or optimistic about peace in the Middle East? Insofar as the near future, insofar as human endeavors, we are pessimistic. Does not mean that they won't be able to accomplish some measures of peace. They've had done it before, they can do it again, but whatever they accomplish will be temporary. Any peace treaties that were accomplished by human endeavor will eventually collapse. An ultimate peace will come between Israel and the Arab states, either by means of occupation or by means of destruction, but gratefully also by means of conversion. We'll see a time when masses of the Islamic world will begin to turn to the God of Israel through Yeshua, through Jesus the Messiah. And we'll see our many Muslims coming to faith both in the Arab world and the Islamic world outside the Arab population. The Palestinians are simply part of the Arab peoples, and they claim the same land Israel claims, but that is not the divine purpose. Therefore, there's no special future for Palestinian state, because that's simply Israel. And the Arab population of Palestine, that those who can become believers, will simply move into the future of the Arabs in the Arab countries. But whatever peace is accomplished will simply be temporary. They might unilaterally declare themselves a state. They may even be recognized by the majority of the UN. But on the divine side, there can be no Palestinian state. This is the land that God gave to Jewish people. And whatever they accomplish, human effort, will be temporary. When God takes control, it will last and last forever. This is my last session, but I'll be around all day. But let me just say a few things just for repetition from yesterday. If you like these kinds of studies, if you go to our table in the foyer inside the smaller room, you'll see a table, and there'll be these REL brochures, the ministry which I represent. Inside will be a place that you can give us your name and address. We send out a newsletter every 3 months, four times a year, that has an inserted four-page Bible study. Every issue picks a topic and then teaches it from the same perspective, and you can separate from the rest of the newsletter and use it. God may give you the opportunity to use it. When you receive it, it's free of charge. Simply fill out this form, tear it off, and leave it there on the table with the people there. And you fill this out, we'll send you some more information about the ministry, including the catalog and my personal testimony. Also then begin to send you a newsletter. And after that, every 3 months, let me run to receive it. Also,